This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 111 was recorded March 29th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Longtime Macro Voices listeners know that MI2 Partners founder Julian Brigden has been one of our most popular guests ever, but it's been way too long since we've had him on the show. Julian returns as this week's feature interview guest, and we'll discuss treasury yields, inflation, the Mexican standoff Julian sees between the Fed and equity markets, and a whole lot more. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview when Patrick and I will return for extended equity market coverage in our postgame segment.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 now for about 3 days has hovered in this tight range just above the 2600 handle. And we're like waiting in suspense to find out whether this gives out. What's your feeling about the S&P here?
Well, there's so much to say. I'm going to defer most of it to the postgame segment because I think we really need to reinvoke the chart book that you first introduced our listeners to right after the vol complex blew up and look at the way that this correction is playing out, contrasting it to the way that other corrections of approximately 10% or so have played out in the last several years. Briefly, what I'll say for right now is that 2600 or so on the S&P, which was the 200-day moving average, was a logical downside target because that's about as far as the market bottomed the last time, right after the vol complex blew up. Made sense to think that it might bottom again there for approximately the same level before moving higher and completing a correction cycle. The thing is, Patrick, I don't think that the bottom is in. I think it still has more to go, but in order to facilitate that discussion, we really need to get to your chart book. So let's come back to the equity market and the various scenarios that could play out after the feature interview with Julian Brigden.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, because just even three sessions ago, we were on the verge of retesting those January, February lows, and it's like the dollar was creeping to the edge of the cliff, asking whether Juliette de Klerk was going to be right or not. And suddenly, we have this big reversal with the dollar index now back to the 90 handle. Was this just a bottoming formation on the dollar? What do you think is happening here?
You know, it's a mystery, and it fascinates me that more and more people, it's not just Juliet, more people are saying, okay, that's it, the dollar's toast, the top is in, it's all downhill from here. And I'm looking at the chart saying, okay, are they looking at a different chart than I'm looking at? I understand that there are some very good dollar bearish arguments that people are making, but as I look at the chart, it doesn't look to me to be over by any stretch. We'll see what happens here. I definitely want to ask Julian his view, but as far as I'm concerned, I think that there's a very strong argument that I'm definitely persuaded by, which is the secular bearish view on the dollar that says in the long run, the dollar is in the process of losing its hegemony over the global financial system. And over a period of years, I definitely think that the dollar will weaken relative to other currencies. The question, though, is in the shorter term, is there room for that short squeeze, that one last hurrah or safety trade higher in the dollar? And I still think there is. Julian Brigden shared that view. Last time we spoke to him was a year ago, though. So let's get an update from him when we get to the feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil. And I thought it was really interesting because I was reading Mark Cudmore's piece on Bloomberg, and he was already fishing for the idea that this could be a double top on oil, you know, and where he once again tested that 66 level on the upside. I feel it's a little early to be calling a double top, but what do you think? Is this where we could see the rejection?
Well, Patrick, that's one of the scenarios that I'm considering, but it's certainly not the only one. As our regular listeners know, my previous view had been that WTI should have moved through a bearish resolution to that triangle pattern we had in the daily chart, moving down below $60 and headed down towards 55 by now. Of course, everything changed on the morning of Friday, March 16th. Now, at the time, we couldn't figure out what was happening because there was no apparent news to explain the very sudden move up in prices. In hindsight, my guess is that's when people first started to get inside information about John Bolton's appointment as National Security Advisor. The next really big move came on Friday the 23rd, and that was in the wake of the Thursday the 22nd announcement publicly of Bolton's appointment as National Security Advisor. Now, to be sure, Bolton is a pretty serious neoconservative. He was one of the original signers of the Project for a New American Century, which openly advocated destabilizing Iraq. This was right around the turn of the century, and this was a neoconservative think tank piece, which basically said that in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union, that the U.S. should be more assertive and more imperialistic and in its policies. So this guy is definitely no stranger to war, and I think that a lot of people freaked out because they said, oh boy, Bolton could be the guy that really pushes Trump towards some kind of shooting war with Iran. And of course, that could have a dramatic impact on energy markets. Now, many people are saying, as Mark Cudmore is, that, okay, that was a panic. It doesn't mean that we're about to go to war. It just means that a guy who's kind of a neocon is in the cabinet. And really, it pushed us to a little bit of a hysterical double top. The top is in, and it's now all downhill from here. Goldman Sachs was among the voices that said there's a good chance that this was a double top, and we're set up to move back down towards $60 or below. Now, despite my previous views, I'm not so sure here. Certainly, it is true that if this is a geopolitical false alarm, so to speak, I think we should be moving toward much lower prices. We're finally seeing inventories start to reverse their trend toward at least small builds in Cushing, Oklahoma. And, you know, I think there's reason to think that prices move lower here. On the other hand, there are indeed signs that Trump is assembling something of a war cabinet. That triangle pattern that we broke out of to the upside on the 16th of March has a 67.76 target as a minimum, and we haven't gotten there yet. So I think it could go either way. This presents a real conundrum. If you think that we really are on the path towards a change of White House policy that is going to be much more aggressive, and there's going to be an aggressive reimposition of sanctions and potentially risking outright armed military conflict with Iran, hey, for sure, that could easily send prices another $15 higher. I would not for an instant be surprised by that. If cooler heads prevail and that's not happening, and this was just a false alarm when people freaked out over John Bolton's appointment, then we could be moving back down towards $50 or even lower if there was a panic unwind of that 1.3 billion barrel now, all-time record speculative long interest in combined crude oil and other energy products. The petro-yuan contract, China's new oil contract, is trading. One of the big questions is, does the presence of that contract undermine the ability of the United States to shut down exports out of Iran? In other words, if the U.S. were to reimpose sanctions, would the petro-yuan contract provide an out for Iran that the U.S. couldn't do anything about? There are differing views on that, but most people I talk to seem to think probably not. They think that the U.S. could shut down Iranian exports again if they wanted to, through a process of sanctions and international pressure. As far as inventory this week, crude oil building 1.6 million barrels nationally. Cushing, Oklahoma, building even more, 1.8 million barrels, which of course is a welcome reprieve after we had quite a few weeks in a row of Cushing drawdowns. Gasoline drawing down 3.5 million barrels, distillates drawing down 2 million barrels. So crude builds, product drawdowns, market could not decide what to do about that. It was very sharply up, then it was sharply down, then it was sharply up again, and eventually the resolution was down. Production was up another 26,000 barrels per year. Patrick, just to put that number in context, 20,000 barrels per week if it is sustained, in other words, if every single week we were to see a 20,000 barrel increase over the week prior, over the course of a year, that would equate to an additional 1 million barrels per year of U.S. output. So kind of think of that as a multiplier. At this point, we're at 26,000 barrels this week. That's equivalent to about 1.25 million barrels per year if that rate of increase were sustained every single week. Of course, we don't know whether it is, but all indications are that we will see a sustained increase in U.S. production, primarily as a result of growth in the Permian Basin. The market, again, couldn't decide what this inventory report meant, but eventually moved much lower. Then we moved higher today. Thursday was the last day of the month and quarter. It appears to me that for most of the latter half of the day, people with a vested interest in that closing price, because every penny of price in crude oil actually translates for all of these managed money funds to several hundred millions of dollars of profits and therefore hundreds of millions of dollars of fees that they make on it. They were trying to game things higher. They got up to approximately the five-day moving average at 65.25. And just in the last few minutes before the close, there was a really strong round of selling, which says to me that the downside is not finished for this market. I wouldn't be surprised if we end up moving lower next week.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. You know, and when we had that breakout earlier heading up toward 1350, that hidden gold bug deep inside of me was almost hoping that this gold breakout was for real heading to 1400. But as soon as that dollar reversed, gold just slammed right down to 1325. And that correlation seems to be sticking. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, we already had the conundrum that gold was so much all about the dollar, and as the dollar moves up, gold gets clobbered. I think what happened here was the John Bolton appointment and fears about an Iranian geopolitical escalation were chiefly behind the really big move up that we saw. As a result, as those fears are starting to abate, we're seeing it come back off. So now the jury is still out on the dollar, but also I think the jury is very much still out on the geopolitical trend, which is compounding the issue. And I don't know where it's headed. On one hand, it seems like everybody has stopped worrying about this. But on the other hand, it is also true that Bolton is a very hawkish guy. It seems that President Trump is getting more and more unhappy with the Iran situation. I think it's almost a certainty that the Iran nuclear deal will be stepped away from on May 12th, I believe, is the review date. The question is there then an aggressive reimposition of sanctions, or does it end there? I think that we'll have to wait and see. The key support level is around 1308. That was just holding, and then we had this geopolitical escalation. That's going to be the number to watch in terms of if the dollar continues to strengthen, do we see a move below 1308? And if so, there's a potential risk of an acceleration to the downside toward the low 1200s.
All right. Well, let's move on to Treasury bond yields, because they've been receding after retesting, almost approaching that 295 again just a week ago. We now see ourselves down around the 275 yield, and the yield's receding here. Is this is that the top here on the short term? Where do you think yields are going?
Well, that's the question, and it really makes me wonder. We've discussed the scenario on the show previously about the possibility of a short squeeze in yields. I think there is a good argument, Julian Brigden is going to echo it in today's interview, that Jeff Gundlach has made, saying on a secular basis, higher yields are coming. The thing is, with this just radical speculative positioning, there's so much possibility of a short squeeze, and I think that it's going to be very interesting to see what happens from here. 2.60 is a key technical level. Julian's going to have much more to say in the feature interview.
All right. Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. So this week's featured interview guest is MI2 Partners founder Julian Brigden. Eric's interview with Julian is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is MI2 Partners founder Julian Brigden. As always, Julian has prepared an outstanding slide deck for us. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or if you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the download and registration instructions next to Julian's picture on our homepage. Julian, I know last time we spoke, it was a very similar market environment. You had made some money for your clients on a short treasury trade. You had then told them to cover and were waiting for a bounce to put that back on. I think that since then, you have put that back on. You've made some more money for them, and I think at least partially you've started to take it off. So how do things look as we start to look into your slide deck here in terms of what we're seeing in today's market?
Thanks very much for having me back on the show, Eric, and it's been way, way, way too long. So, you know, talking about the treasury market, big picture, we firmly believe that we saw the lows in treasury yields in 2016, and it was structurally in a bear market. But we did recently, having been pretty aggressive shorts into Q4, recommend that clients back off on those a little bit, not fully, but to some extent. And it's just because we've come up to some very big levels. So if you look at the chart pack that we've attached to this, you can see in 10-year yields, you know, this 3.305 level is a very big level in the treasury market. And we're sort of sandwiched between, you know, the low 260s and that three level. And I think we sort of continue to mess around in that level. In 30s is actually even bigger. We put in here a chart that takes you right back into the early 80s. And you can see that we've got this sort of inverse head and shoulders pattern, which is built over the last sort of 4 to 5 years. That neckline comes in at around this sort of 315, 325 level. We've also got a very long-term trend line, and a number of people have used this one, 30-year trend line. I'm not really a big fan of taking something over that long a period, but the one that I really love, which is one that a colleague of mine, one of my partners uses, is this simple moving average. It's 100-month simple moving average. And this has held the bond market all the way since 1985. And it comes in at around 325, 326. And we've actually never, ever closed above it since 1985. We opened above it once in 94, but we closed below it. And to me, this is a big level. So these are big, big levels in the bond market, which is why we recommended taking some cash off the table in the shorts. But bigger picture, as you can see on slide 5, the models are still telling us that this is a highly distorted market. This is a market where 10-year yields on balance should be about 100 basis points higher. And what's really driven this is, despite what, say, the Fed may believe, I mean, I think it's interesting that just before Janet Yellen retired, she gave a speech where she said, you know, QE had lowered treasury yields. We frankly just don't believe that. We don't think it stacks up to the evidence. In fact, you look at the bouts of Fed QE, you'll see that if you look at this chart here, where you look at to the real interest rate differential between CPI and 10-year yields, you'll see that real yields didn't fall at all. Well, if QE lowered bond yields, that's what should have happened. You should have gone into negative territory. And in fact, the only policy that did that was Operation Twist. So what actually lowered treasury yields through almost all the period of QE was falling inflation. It was disinflation. Now, I use that term because I'm not a big believer in deflation. Deflation is falling aggregate demand and falling prices. What we had was falling inflation. So it's disinflation. And that's really what lowered yields. And what's been interesting, though, is since the end of 2015, inflation's actually been rising and relatively significantly in the US. It's gone up a whole 2%. But yields, real yields, have fallen. Why? Because other central banks have come in. And they've, because of the nuances of their policies, particularly NERP, and particularly regulatory requirements that require European investors to be, you know, fully invested and match assets with liabilities, you've had this tsunami of cash that's come out of Japan and Europe and suppressed our treasury yields.
Let me interrupt you there for a second, Julian, because we've heard so many views on inflation ranging from, 2% inflation's back, but it's not a big deal, it's all contained, to Hugh Hendry telling us, okay, look, this is 1965. We're about to see an epic inflation as big as the 70s. Is it somewhere in between? What's your view in terms of what could be on the horizon for inflation?
But it's funny that Hugh brings up the 60s, because that's something that we've been talking about for the best part of 2 years. And if you look at the slide, you'll see our immediate forecasts for inflation here, Eric. So our corporate pricing model, which tends to lead headline PCE, is just hoofing it. And we haven't been this high since 2011, when headline PCE was close to 3. I put a quote in there from the market PMI composite for the US, and you can see we are not the only people who are seeing this pressure. And I think I highlighted on this chart the drop in oil prices. It was this drop in oil prices which caused this deflationary scare. As I said, I don't believe it was deflation, because aggregate demand, even in the US with a bloody large oil industry, didn't actually fall. What we had was a disinflationary pressure. And actually, the problem was, is the central banks panicked and they threw the kitchen sink at the problem, particularly the Japanese and the Europeans. And now they're going to pay the price for that, because we've overcooked the goose. And we are slowly starting to get these inflationary pressures. We think, you know, they will start to emerge. So if you look at the next slide here, you'll see core CPI. These are the lows, according to our work. And so by early next year, okay, we are going to be well above target in the United States. And even in Europe, we're seeing some input pricing models that we've built, where we took sort of 2,800 input costs and we filtered them and found a bunch that were leading. Our work suggests that you are potentially on the cusp of a big increase in these input-led prices. Now, it's possible, look, if the equity market just implodes, fine, then companies won't pass these price increases on. But these prices are already in the system, and this is what I fear, Eric. So I think we've already got some inflation, some nascent inflation. I think the dip in inflation was a panic caused by an oil price cycle. We talked about that, I think, actually last time I was on the show. And this is even before we spend all the money that we're going to, right? I think people forget that the budget this year has to be spent by the 31st of September. So we've got a lot of money to spend in the US, courtesy of Trump's budget, over the next 6 months. We've obviously got the tax cut. It would be classic if we got a little bit of an equity wobble, you know, say a 20%er, that would set you up for a big infrastructure spending package, right? All of this, to exactly what Hugh talked about, reminds us of the 60s. And if you look on this slide here, you'll see back then we had this incredibly stable period of low inflation, incredibly stable, 6 years where inflation basically oscillated around sort of 1.3. Okay. You had a Fed that thought they could run it a little hot because they believed in the Phillips curve, unlike this lot that don't believe in the Phillips curve. Okay. And you did, and you hit the economy quickly with a bunch of spending. Well, you overcooked the goose. And I'm not even showing in this slide the 70s. I'm not interested. But in those 5 years, where inflation goes from 1.6 to the upper threes, then back down again as they aggressively try to hit again, and then breaks out again and goes up to almost 6, Treasury investors lost 36% of their money in real price terms. 36%, a third, and you never got it back. Never got it back. So I do think the analogy is relatively similar.
Julian, let me ask you a question about this inflation that you see coming. As I look at slide 8 here, you know, it looks like you kind of see things heading quite a bit higher. I've always felt like, you know, people have talked ever since 2009, did they really fix anything or not? I've always said that it's when inflation starts to run away that we really find out what the scary part of this story looks like. Because whether you want to call it disinflation or deflation or whatever, if you don't have an inflation problem, you can conjure money out of thin air to solve almost any problem. When you're fighting an inflation risk, the Fed's hands are tied suddenly. And it seems to me like that's really the big risk of where you get to the point where the government can't do anything about the problem. Would you agree with that? And if so, how far are we away from that scenario?
I would agree wholeheartedly. In fact, you know, as far back as sort of 2016, middle of 2016, we wrote a piece called "The Real Risk is Economic Strength, Not Weakness." Look, in theory, growth and inflation is exactly what these guys have been aiming for, these central banks. The problem, Eric, is in the process of trying to create that economic strength, and inflation. They have so distorted financial markets by nailing risk assets to the ceiling and yields and rates, and I draw a distinction between the two, one being the bond market, one being official rates, to the floor, that they've essentially created a Gordian knot for themselves, this inescapable circle, vicious circle. So what happens on the day where we get, and we had a glimpse of this when we got that high wage number a couple of months ago, what happens on the day when you get that high inflation or that wage number? And you walk in and the bond market is down, yields are up hard, and the equity market, rather than greeting this as a positive sign, is actually down hundreds of points. Then what does the central bank do? And I think we've already, from my discussions I've got with friends of mine who used to work with me at Medley in DC, we already have a central bank that has gone through, is going through a high degree of navel gazing with the likes of Mester and now Powell, talking about their concerns about, hey, may, and look, it's obvious to most of us, but this is not obvious to central bankers initially, that the QE and all their policies may have aggravated social inequalities, may have been responsible for massive economic allocation, which should not be their job. So I loved it at the end of last year where people, you know, we had that wobble in the equity market and people were saying, oh, well, the Fed's got to be in when the market's down 5%. You're dreaming. You're smoking the strongest stuff that I can buy down the road in Colorado, because it's just not even close. Not even close. So, yes, I absolutely agree with you that the easy markets, Eric, are when you have economic weakness, when the ISM is pushing 46 or 47, and these central banks can talk about printing more money and levitating assets while keeping risks and rates and yields nailed to the lows. The problem occurs, and there has been no test of this since 2009, when yields and rates have to start to rise.
Now, let me make sure that I'm assimilating what you're telling us here correctly. We've come down to flirting with 3%. It sounds like you're saying, hey, that's a logical, very strong support level in yields. We probably should expect at least some kind of bounce off of that. But you think then it's going to be inflation coming into the picture that will eventually push us through that 305 level on the 10-year yield. And it sounds like you're saying maybe that's where all hell starts to break loose, but it's really through 325 where you're talking about a game changer in the sense of breaking that long-term moving average, which, as you said, has not been closed above in decades. Is that pretty much the picture so far as what I'm pulling together from
this?
Yeah,
I mean, exactly. So, you know, we've come, yields have risen a decent amount. They are, and we'll talk about this in a second, they have an impact, right? But our gut is that we are not going back to 1.5%. All right, that would take a calamitous collapse in equities. And while I'm bearish on equities at the moment, and I think there are lots of structural problems that we'll come to in a second, I think that there would come a point, obviously, where irrespective of inflation, central banks would calculate that there's going to be enough of a drop in equities that would undermine the economic growth, and they'll step in and try and catch it again. But every time they keep doing this, Eric, they keep supporting the cycle in inflation. And that's actually what happened in the 60s and the 70s. Right, you go from this very period of super low stable inflation. Inflation starts to break out a little bit. The central bank thumps it, but it doesn't go back to the previous low. And then when the equity market wobbles or the housing market wobbles, as it did in 1966, they back off. But then inflation comes through again, and you build this oscillating cycle. In science and, you know, in all sorts of things, and flow dynamics and whatever, and we referred to it last year, is this accelerative oscillation. So the oscillations get bigger and bigger, and policy error begets policy error. And that's kind of where I think we are. But, you know, we've hit some big levels. So if I go back to the slide again, you can see we raised the question on slide 12, you know, high yields, it won't be linear. Okay, there are consequences. We talk about two steps forward, one step back. So we know there are sectors of the economy which are suffering a little bit. So if you look at slide 13, we've already seen car sales top out at around 18 million. It's a sine wave, believe it or not, in the US, irrespective of how many people we have in the country, irrespective of how much finance we sell at, throw at them. We pretty much base around 8 or 9 million, and we top at around 18 million. Contribution of this sector now towards GDP is zero. And we have to ask ourselves, if you were to spike rates that much more, particularly at the short end where a lot of the financing goes on, how much damage would it do? Another big area which I'm particularly watching at the moment is housing. Housing is generally led by mortgage application for purchase, which you can see on slide 14 here in red. Okay, that has dipped into the low single digits. When rates were on their low back in 2016, mortgage application for purchase was running at about 15% for 16% year over year. So a third of that, right? There are consequences. And let's not forget, this is all occurring in an environment where, given where median house prices are, okay, this has a material impact on affordability. So if you look on slide 15, you'll see the cost of buying an existing home in red or a new home in yellow here is almost, well, in the new home case, it definitely is above the highs of 2005 or 2006, okay? But in existing is pretty close to it. So I know we hear great stories about the demographics of, you know, all these millennials living in mum's basement, gagging to go and move into a new house, okay? I don't care. They can't afford it, okay? So any further tightening of rates is going to really hurt the housing sector. We may have already done a fair bit of damage, and certainly the stocks in that sector suggest that we have. Finally, in the real economy, you're starting to see some signs of late cycle credit stress. Now, if you look on slide 16, what I've done here is I've charted all the defaults rates of the big credit cards. And I think it's interesting that Cabela's, you know, the sporting goods store, clearly it's indicative of their client base not exactly being the highest credit out there. They picked the lows in 2005 when credit stress started to appear, but they did in 2014 again. But I think it's more interesting when you look at people like Discovery, you know, mainstream credit card, you're starting to see the highest default rates you've seen since 2014. So there are definitively in the real economy, Eric, big potential problems, but it's the equity market which really worries me, I have to admit.
I'm glad you came to that, Julian, because there are so many different views. We should let our listeners know we are speaking on Wednesday afternoon, a day before this podcast will be released, where the market just closed at 26.08 on the S&P. What is your outlook as we had basically a flat day, very slightly down, just barely off of the 200-day moving average? What comes next for equities?
So we've tried to maintain a relatively sort of bullish stance, but there have been some things that have increasingly worried us since the end of last year. And in fact, for the last, well, really since the middle of February, we've been hedging our short bond position with a short position in European equities, which were just technically the ones that we really didn't like the price action in. But clearly in the last couple of weeks, things have started to look increasingly questionable here in the United States. And I think it's not the macro story that worries us per se, Eric. It's this dichotomy between rates and yields and equity valuations, which really worried us. And we saw, obviously, as yields started to break higher and the Fed started to get more hawkish, that the equity market has been challenged. But there are some structural things that really keep me awake at night. The first thing is that when you look at some of the flow, and there are various different ways to measure this, but one of them we have on slide 18, it does appear that retail has got sucked into the market, which would classically be the case at the wrong time. And one of the metrics we look to look at that is the divergence between the Dow and this index called the Smart Money Flow Index. So the Smart Money Flow Index was created by Investor Chronicle, and it looks at times of the day basically by excluding the first hour or so of the trading day where they think there's a lot of retail money and orders that come in overnight, and concentrating on the last hour of the day. And then it recreates the index. And the idea is to parse out what they call smart or really institutional flow. And what you can see here on slide 18 is this massive divergence since the election between the overall Dow and the smart money flow index, implying that it's retail money that has got sucked into this market at the highs. The second structural concern we have is when we look at some of that smart money. Now, I think I've shared with this you with your clients in the past, but we created this, what we call an ammo index, okay? And it's designed, it doesn't tell you anything about timing, nothing about timing whatsoever. It is just designed to give you an idea about how much ammo, what is the ability of institutional money, or leveraged in this case, institutional money, to absorb some sort of shock. And if you think about it like on a video game, the lower the ammo, the worse scenario case you are in. So the lower index, the worst case the situation is. So what you can see here is that the ammo index is actually very recently, at the end of last year, went through the lows of 2000, saying that the ability of leverage players to absorb any sort of exogenous shock via their, you know, value at risk models, or VAR models as people refer to them, is exceedingly low. They are exceedingly vulnerable. And it's in that context that the slide on slide 20 worries me the most. We have had a market where, and you know how this works, Eric, where you could assume very large amounts of risk because volatility was so incredibly low, right? But as we all know, we've all heard the stats about how unusual it is for the VIX, which is emblematic of that, to trade at 10 or below, which is what we were doing at the end of last year. Well, we flagged this to our clients and we said, we're worried. In fact, we gave them a very simple metric to watch, which I haven't put in the chart pack, which is just the spread between the VIX and the VXN, or the NASDAQ vol. And we said, whenever that spread gets to the NASDAQ VXN trading over the VIX by about 6.5 to 7.5 vol spreads, watch out, because it can't stay there. One of two things happens. Either the NASDAQ vol relaxes, okay, and we roll over and everything is fine, or the VIX is going to start to accelerate. And it flagged it very well going into 2007. We got this kind of move. It flagged the ETN blow up, which we had in February. And once again, as of the close today, that spread is at 7.32 vol spreads. So it just worries me we're in a higher vol environment, Eric. And as you know, the way that that works in the risk models is that reduces the amount of risk that you can buy. And so in a falling market, the ability of leverage to buy, or institutional money to necessarily buy dips, is going to be severely constrained in an environment where retail is already long. So these are the structural things that worry me. And while over the next 10 years, fine, I'm okay, you know, when it comes to equities, I think certainly if we're in an inflation environment, they'll outperform fixed income. They're in for a bit of a shock, I fear. I fear we're on the cusp of of a 20%er. You know, it could be potentially worse. And I do feel personally that we put the highs in. You know, and I've said, you know, look, either the market has to collapse under its own weight for whatever reason, higher vol, trade talks, whatever, and then the Fed backs off, or faced with the inflation picture, the Fed is just going to keep hiking until they eventually crack the market. It won't be intentional. It's never intentional, but it's what always happens. So I fear that the highs are in.
Now, I'm very curious to probe a little bit on that idea of the highs being in, because everything you've said about the structural direction being towards higher treasury yields, which is clearly not going to help the stock market, I'm with you on that. I think there's a lot of reasons for concern, but there's one specific scenario that I've been toying with that I'd like to run by you and just get you to grade me on it, so to speak, which is, as you said earlier, we just got to a resistance level in treasury yields on the 10-year yield at around 3%. We got to, I think, 2.95 or 96. We've come off of that, and I know that you had told your clients to go ahead and take profits on their shorts there. It seems to me, with the incredible record short positioning that we see in the commitment of traders reports, that we're set up potentially for a short squeeze in bonds that could bring treasury yields down substantially, maybe, just maybe, I would think, opening the door to one last hurrah higher, to a new all-time highs in the stock market, let's say into the middle of the summer, and then things really, really get ugly in the second half. You said, though, despite it seems like we started with all the same ideas that got us into this, your view is the high is already in, and that's not happening. Why is that?
So the first thing I would say is that I think that's always a risk. But I would personally, I think that if you're going to get significantly lower bond yields, so like through those 260 kind of levels, which I flagged in chart, I think you're going to need a major risk off event. So in other words, really significantly lower equity market. And I don't, it's possible we're on the cusp of that now, but that in that case, that's the driver. So at this point, I do think that bonds are a little bit of a hostage to the equity market. I do think if the equity market were, however, to rebound and remain resilient, I don't see any way possible, given my macro backdrop for higher inflation, yields are going to come down a lot. In fact, I would imagine with a strong equity market, we'll be pushing the upper ends of those 305. In 10 years and 325 in 30s. And in fact, I have to say that the price action for those people who, you know, and someone in your same camp who's looking for those shorts to get squeezed, that the price action of the bond market in the face of a 10% correction in the equity market is bloody appalling, to be honest, Eric. We have dropped a whole 20 basis points off the highs.
Am I correct to interpret that the really big signal that you're waiting for, it sounds like you think it's pretty darn close at hand, would be a close, let's say it's a weekly close or at least a daily close, above 3.05 on the 10-year treasury or 3.25 on the 30-year? That's where its different game is on at this point. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, certainly the 325, 326 on the 30 years is a monthly signal. So you'd have to, I really would want to see that confirming monthly. But obviously, a month is a long time to wait for price action. So yes, those would, initially breaks above those levels would be, to me, significant. And I think, you know, I think one of the things beyond just that up move in yields, even if we sit here, Eric, and the equity market is down, because remember, the equity market can come down, you know, even if yields don't rise, if they think that the Fed is going to deliver into a down market because inflation has risen, right, maybe the curve is still flattening, okay, so yields actually don't rise, it is a tightening of financial conditions. And to me, that is definitively a clear risk. We are just in a very different environment. We're in an environment where up until the end of last year, the equity market had not been challenged since 2009 by any tightening of either really of yields or of rates. And that, to me, that picture has now changed. So they can't just willy-nilly rally back up to the highs and not, with this macro backdrop of higher inflation, and not expect the end result, if they try to be either the Fed hiking more aggressively or bond yields breaking out. And I think this inability for fixed income to hedge an equity portfolio, to me, is dire. Even if bond yields just, I mean, so far they haven't really acted as a hedge since the beginning of the year, right? And I think you must be, most of your clients, in fact, most investors in the world now are in what we would call these modern balanced portfolios. These portfolios where essentially you have been perfectly hedged by owning a pool of risk assets and a pool of fixed income. But that's really only worked since 1998. And it's one of the things that we've been stressing to our clients. Since the central banks came in and introduced the Greenspan put, which has been carried on via QE and so forth. In other words, this ability, whenever risk assets wobble, to intervene and lower rates and boost bond prices has only worked in the last 20 years. For 230 years, according to the Bank of England, prior to that, it never worked. And the defining difference was, prior to 98, we were concerned about inflation. Post 98, we've been concerned about deflation. And I certainly think that for the next year or so, and years going forward, if the Trump thing really keeps rolling through, we have to be concerned about inflation. And that's just going to change that whole relationship between bond and equities. Both can go down together. You can lose money on both. And you have, in that scenario, no hedge.
Let's talk about that specifically, because so many people are not only protected against that, but they are levered up in these risk parity profiles. They've levered up the bonds, and they are not prepared for the situation where both bonds and stocks are selling off at the same time. If that begins to happen, it seems to me it potentially becomes self-reinforcing. And one of the things that I wonder about is where the money goes. If they're both selling off and people are liquidating institutionally, they can't stay in cash. Institutions, by mandate, have to go someplace. Where does what's left of their assets go as it comes out of both equities and bonds?
Well, the first thing to say, if you use the 60s analogy, it is true that it's a slow process. So as I said, it's this two-step forward, one-step back. So this is a multi-year process we're talking about if we do try and finally engender some inflation into the system. And so to some extent, while money does slosh about, a lot of money gets, like the proverbial frog, gets boiled in the hot water, right? The bond investor doesn't notice that in real terms he's getting crushed. And let's be honest, we all know that societally, we need to inflate away the value of this debt. So I think it's important to just make that. Now, short term, what you would expect to see is you should expect to see some of the commodity markets start to outperform. And here's the proviso, on a relative basis, right? On a relative basis. So versus the equity market, commodities should start to do well. I think it's overdue. We haven't yet advocated that to our clients. The most we got to our retail client base who subscribed to the Macro Insider piece, was at the end of last year, we actually suggested allocating for the first time in a very long time some money to precious metals. It's not a big aggressive trade. We think it's got perhaps potentially a bit more further downside as we think there's one more leg up in the dollar. But yeah, the commodity sector on a relative basis, typically in higher inflationary environments, does better. The equity market is much more volatile. So like 1960 to 1965, you made 80% being invested in the S&P. You know, you made money in the bond market. Everything was great. 1966, the equity market drops 20% as the bond market starts to break out and yields start to rise. Now, it then rebounded. You only made, from the previous high, another 15% over the next 4 to 5 years. But you did make money. Okay, it was more volatile. It was more difficult. You had to be a more active trader. All this passive would be classic if everyone's got passive investors right at the cycle high of and the cycle low of volatility. Okay, that would be classic wealth destruction. Okay, but you did make money. Okay, you got killed in the bond market. So the thing that you can't be invested in is bonds, and you have to manage your risk now in equities much more aggressively.
Let's come back to the U.S. dollar you mentioned briefly, because we haven't gotten to that at all yet. What is your view on the dollar?
So when we look at the dollar, there's been three sort of structural things that have worried us. The big structural issue, and I think I've discussed this on previous episodes with your clients, is this low U.S. current account deficit relative to global GDP. Now, just very briefly, essentially, as the reserve provider of the world, we have to supply the world with those reserves. And the way we do that is running a current account deficit. It has to increase roughly in line with the growth of global GDP. And since 2006, courtesy of shale, where we've substituted imported oil for domestic oil, the current account deficit in the United States has collapsed. And someone needs to tell the Trump administration if they want the dollar to be the reserve currency, they can't keep harping on about lowering the current account deficit. Now, we've had episodic bouts of dollar strength in that period, most notably when the Fed tapered, okay, in 2014, and the dollar, like a ball, a ball that's been pressed below the surface of the water, as soon as you take your hands off, shot up to the surface. And that was a shortfall of dollars in the system, because the way that we have filled the gap left by the collapsing current account deficit is through capital exports from the capital account. So hot money has flowed overseas. Okay. And if you go and look at things like shares outstanding in European equity ETFs, you'll see that we've been doing it increasingly over the last few years in unhedged. So in other words, US investors own European stocks in euros. That's the fundamental instability at the heart of the system. And it is horribly unstable, horribly, horribly unstable. We've relied on this capital outflow, but a lot of that capital outflow has been linked to the Fed's QE. So as they start to accelerate QT in Q2 and Q3 of this year, the risk is that capital outflow will get constrained. The second issue that we've been worried about has been the repatriation story. Not so much because we think there's a lot of euros to be sold to buy dollars, but because we are concerned that the changes to things like Basel III and the Volcker Rule have changed the plumbing of how you take a dollar in the United States and lend it overseas. So if a dollar that's sitting in Dublin or sitting in Geneva in a corporate account that up until now has not wanted to come home suddenly comes home and goes back to New York and is used for buybacks, that money isn't there to fund a dollar liability overseas, not immediately. Eventually it'll seep out through the system, but not immediately. So we've been concerned that the dollar is highly unstable, and there are these factors, Fed contracting the balance sheet, US investors balancing the equation, but heavily invested in domestic current, in overseas currencies, and this repatriation could create this tipping point. And I see the LIBOR tightening as indicative partly of that effect. The low on the LIBOR OIS spread actually occurred in mid-December, I believe, and it was at the point at which the Fed's balance sheet went negative year over year. The second big jump came on the passage of the tax bill, the corporate tax bill. So both of those, to me, are indicative of tightening overseas dollar liquidity. Okay, it's yet to feed it through itself into the dollar, but I'm worried that if this equity sell-off accelerates, that US investors, and this I think would be the triggering, we see the sort of dollar move as the last move of a risk-off dollar move. The US investors look at their euro stocks investment in euros and go, oh, I don't like the euro stocks anymore. They sell it. As they sell it, they buy dollars, bringing their money home. And so the dollar move is going to be the laggard of the risk-off move. But when it happens, and we know this, Eric, when the dollar rallies at the same time as you get risk-off, it turns things really vicious really quickly. And given this massive hole created by a low current account deficit, with the whole world depending on hot money flows, in a world where you can click and bring that money home, it could be really vicious. Now, once that's happened, you know, we've reset it. I believe the dollar sinks for the next decade or so. What the Trump administration is doing is tantamount, I think, to undermining the long-term value of the dollar in a system where it's very different from cycles in the past, right? You know, we're trying to fight a new Cold War. We're going to try and spend a lot of money. We can't afford it. It's not like the 60s when, you know, the big buyers of our debt were our friends, the Germans and the Koreans, who we were providing military umbrellas to. Now it's the Chinese. Things are just not structurally good long-term out for the dollar, but we still live in a legacy dollar system where there is a structural shortfall. And if we trigger that by causing capital flight back to the United States, God help us.
Now, conventional macro wisdom says that as Treasury yields increase and therefore the yield becomes more attractive relative to other sovereigns. That's supposed to cause a lot of international capital flow into the dollar, strengthening the dollar. But I'm seeing a lot of smart people, both what you just said. I listened to Jeff Gundlach's forecast. You know, he sees higher treasury rates, but he also sees a structural lower dollar. It seems like that correlation is just broken down. Is it because of these other flows and the effect that you've described with Trump's policy on the current account deficit that's causing that traditional correlation to break down the way that we're starting to see?
Well, I think, let's be honest, up until now, we've had loose fiscal, relatively loose monetary, right? It's only changed in the last couple of months, and arguably even since Powell's sort of come in. I mean, we've had central banks that have, and I think big picture, they still want to, quote unquote, the expression we like to use is run it hot, right? They want to boil bond investors slowly. They want to run nominal GDP hot. They, you know, this is how we eviscerate the value of the debt in what are aging, you know, very indebted societies. So yeah, loose fiscal, loose monetary is disastrous for a currency. Things are changing a little. As I said, I think the Fed will be forced relatively to become more hawkish. But, you know, bigger picture, what I'm talking about is an episodic, final, nasty, destructive dollar rally. I think it's a dollar rally that ends up resetting the system. I think after the dollar has rallied and destroyed a lot of things, more people will abandon it. You'll see more use of the renminbi, right? We are in a cyclical, I think, decline of the dollar. And I just think that there are imbalances now, which to strike me as very dangerous. You can't be the reserve provider and not structurally provide the world with reserves, which means via the current account deficit, and just totally rely on hot money to be the balancing item in a world where that hot money, Eric, can just click and come home.
In this last hurrah that you envision for the dollar, do you have a target in mind, either dollar index or dollar euro or any other measure?
No, I mean, we're watching levels. It's difficult because at some point central banks come in, right? And they'll just find, you know, whether they extend swap lines again or whatever. So it's a pain level. I don't know whether there's a technical level that I would see per se. It's a pain level. You know, if we look at, you know, everyone focuses on the euro. I'm not sure it's necessarily the one to focus on, but, you know, if I looked at the, you know, I'm sitting in front of my computer now, you know, based on today, the trend line that we're watching comes in around sort of 122.40 off the July lows. It's a pretty clear trend line. There's another decent support at 121.55 if you broke through that, and if you're looking at the dollar index, it's around 91. So, you know, we've been watching these things. We haven't put any of our clients, with the exception of a punt that we took in dollar Canada, which was a nice trade, we haven't put any of our clients into any of the long dollar trades. And as I said, I think it's the final shoe to drop. You know, you get bond pressure and rate pressure and equity problems, and then the dollar comes in and is just the final napalm run into the risk-off move, and then we'll kick off again.
Now, you said earlier that you've covered your bond shorts and taken profits because we hit some target levels. As we see a bounce in price or a dip in yields, it makes me wonder, with what you have in mind for the equity market, is the next bond short another treasury short, or is high yield the place to focus on shorting bonds?
Well, we've taken partial profit on the treasuries. We've still got some. We've advocated keeping some. And that's because we still see those higher inflation prints to come. And, you know, if we broke through 260, I think we'd be out. But we haven't got there, not even close yet. Look, I think in an equity risk-off environment, I think there's a lot of things that are just vastly mispriced. You know, we were looking at some of the spreads between treasuries and BAA. Spreads and those things we're just in super nice downtrends, tightening credit, and they've blown and they're showing no signs of coming back. So I would be very wary of spread product at this point. You know, as I said, longer term, if you take that 60s analogy again, in the second half of the 60s, where they ran it hot. Yes, yields rose, Eric, and I think this is a big point, because people always say to me, oh, but yields can't rise, there's too much debt, the whole world will blow up. And I say to people, look, there's a difference between nominal yields and real yields, right? Nominal yields can rise. In the 60s, they rose from 4 to 8% 10-year Treasury yields. But real yields fell because they just didn't keep up with the nominal inflation and growth story. And I think that is great in a way for indebted companies, provided they have pricing power. And this is when we talk to credit funds, this is the thing they always say to us. Well, if you're right, we're going to get some real pricing discrepancy between in the high yield bond market, because the company with pricing power, okay, the one who can raise their prices in an inflationary environment, their, you know, credit is going to be pristine, whereas the company that can't, let's say the retailer with lots of debt around there, leverage themselves up and lots of, you know, stores that they have to finance, they go bankrupt. So it becomes a much more binary story. Initially, in the risk-off period, yep, they'll all go down. Great opportunity to pick up some stuff that you like, names, but with pricing power.
Well, Julian, it's a real pleasure for me finally to sign off one of these interviews when we're not going to get everybody upset with me. Our institutional listeners have always enjoyed your interviews, and of course they can contact you with respect to MI2 Partners and your institutional advisory service. For many, many interviews, you had no retail offering, which just infuriated our retail audience. That has changed. You have partnered with our friends at Real Vision around something called Macro Insider. Tell us about it.
So Macro Insider is a joint venture that Raoul, who produces his own institutional product, GMI, and I decided to come together and offer for exactly retail clients. And the idea was to keep them abreast and try and help them manage some of the big macro risks. Now, we've gone through a very boring period in macro, and I think you know, that was obvious in the first couple of months of offering the product. But in really since the end of the year, things have started to pick up. We're on the cusp of some of these trades. We're on the cusp of some of these risk factors that we had been shadowing to people. We want to offer people a way to manage these risks, because they're not usually what your equity broker or your guy who's managing your muni portfolio will keep you attuned to. And that's really what we've been trying to do.
Well, Julian, I cannot thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Julian. Great to have him back on the show. I was listening to that interview, and once again, we come up with the idea that there's similarities to the 1960s and this idea that inflation is going to eventually rear its head and we're about to see a 1970s style repeat or something like that. But you know, Eric, I'm going to ask you to help me connect the dots here, because to me, I'm trying to understand where the correlations to the 60s are, because when I think of the 60s, I see a far different picture. I kind of look back, and in the 1960s, there just wasn't, I mean, Julian said it himself, there wasn't a lot of debt back then. And a lot of the arguments today is that with all the debt, can we see the same scenario? But the 1960s saw a period where the national debt of the United States was like $370 billion, just like 2% of today's national debt of $20 trillion. And the debt to GDP was like 35%. And we had this period where the silent generation was a very thrifty one. And we had a system that was constrained by a flawed Bretton Woods system, you know, where credit itself was constrained by the gold standard that was emergent from that. And as in past interviews with Jeffrey Snyder, we saw during the 60s was the emergence of this Eurodollar system. And the Eurodollar system suddenly created all this unconstrained credit creation that was done outside of the Federal Reserve System. And so you had all of this Eurodollar system coming in there. And then you had 1970 roll around, or 71, where Nixon closes the gold window and the entire U.S. banking system gets unhinged from the gold constraints. And suddenly we have a huge, and then you suddenly have this demographic scenario perfectly lining up where the baby boomers are just coming to age of becoming consumers, and they come in there, embrace this credit system. And I think that that was the, at least in my mind, what was the driver of that big inflationary surge. And today we have a massively indebted system that has got deflationary forces, the triple D's of debt, demographics, and technological displacement actually causing resistance there. And I just don't know if I see, I don't know how to connect these dots where this inflation is going to come from. What am I missing here, Eric?
Well, if I assimilate what I hear you saying, I think what you're describing is that in the 60s, we didn't have anything close to the debt, public and private, that exists in the system today. And that meant that it was possible, especially with moving off of the gold standard, for a massive credit expansion to occur. And that credit expansion was able to create a demand-driven, demand-pull type of inflation, where the credit expansion puts more money in people's hands. There, that money is competing for less goods and services. And I agree with you, that same mechanism probably wouldn't be relevant today. But that's not the only way that inflation can start. If you have cost push inflation, which is generated potentially by rising interest rates themselves, in other words, the cost of money is the most expensive price in the entire economic system. It affects the cost of everything else. So if everybody who's been used to easy money and cheap credit for the last decade or so suddenly has a much higher cost and has to pass that cost onto their consumers, that's going to create cost push inflation. Now, it's a cost to push inflation, which I think the consumer is a lot less able to handle, and it's going to create lots of problems. But I don't think it means that you can't have inflation. It's just a different mechanism. I do think, however, that something that is different is we are under the burden of this just mountain of debt. Somehow the resolution of that is going to get scary. The one strong view that I have about all this, I don't know what it's going to take to bring inflation back, but I'm very concerned that when we get a bout of runaway inflation, I think that's when policymakers' hands are tied. As long as you have the ability to just crank up the quantitative easing printing press and conjure more money supply out of thin air, you can deal with a lot of problems. If you're fighting a runaway inflation, you can't do that anymore. And all of a sudden, their hands are tied and you really get into a pickle. So I think that's coming someday. Exactly how it comes, I don't know. And whether or not we're going to see inflation in the near horizon, the way Julian has said, the way that Hugh Hendry has said, I don't know. It's a question in my mind.
Eric, though, I want to push back on that, because the idea of runaway inflation to me, okay, I see the scenario that we could see prices just driving that way. But if we saw a scenario where interest rates double, you know, a scenario that Jim Grant and many others have even suggested as a possibility, I mean, under those circumstances, we're talking about a scenario where, just like Julian was even suggesting, you could see 20% declines in bond prices or more. But at the same time, that would probably result in a stock market repricing that could be 20 to 40% lower on the stock markets, that would double the cost of mortgages, maybe causing a 20, 30% correction in real estate prices. You turn around, that could drive a recession that causes unemployment to go double digits, and maybe even on the verge of some sort of a depression. Like, I don't see a scenario where inflation can run away if we have rising interest rates. It's, I don't know, maybe I'm missing something, but I'm just not connecting the dots.
I think it's a stagflationary risk as opposed, you know, it's not the risk of a roaring 20s style of inflation. I think it's more of a stagflationary risk where you do have inflation in the sense of rising prices, but an economy that's very much unable to weather the cost of those rising prices. Speaking of rising prices or not, let's shift gears and get back to the equity market because I want to get to our extended coverage there. You first produced an excellent series of charts going back to right after the Vol Complex blew up several weeks ago. Listeners, you'll find the link to the post-game chart book in your research roundup email, and I highly encourage you to go ahead and download it because we're going to talk through the equity market relative to several different scenarios in terms of how previous 10% corrections have played out. Patrick, what I started to allude to in the market wrap is there were lots of reasons to think that another retest of the 200-day moving average, right around 2,600 on the S&P, could be the final bottom and that we would just be off to the races from there. But I emphasize the word off to the races from there. Usually what happens when you get to these pivotal highs and bottoms in markets is you get to a capitulation point where the low is in, the smartest money knows the low is in, and buying opportunity doesn't last long. They start buying hand over fist and it goes rocketing back up. It is not normally the case that when there is a epic opportunity to buy the dip, so to speak, that you get a 3 or 4 day grace period where that same price persists, giving you more repeated opportunities to buy it. Generally, if it's the real bottom, it's only going to last for a few minutes and then it's gone. What we've seen in the wake of last Friday's retest of the 200-day moving average is there started to be a little bit of a recovery on Monday and into Tuesday. Then we came all the way back down and tested that same 200-day moving average level again, right around 2590 something, you know, just below 2600. We tested it on Tuesday afternoon. Wednesday's action kind of looked like a diamond bottom in many ways, but we had several opportunities again to get that same level below 2600. We finally saw a move considerably higher during the day on Thursday, although as we're speaking now, just after the close, it looks like a lot of that retraced in the final hour. It says to me that the final bottom is probably not in on this move. Now, the question then becomes, what does that mean if the final bottom is not in? Because a lot of technicians have said, hey, if we break the 200-day moving average, which is also the long-term channel, that means all hell breaks loose and it's 1987 after that. If we can't hold the 200-day and it breaks below it, then we're going, you know, I don't know, to whatever it is, 1500 on the S&P. I don't believe that, Patrick. I think that there's a good chance here of more of a fake break on this 200 level. We need to get to that panic capitulation point where everybody is, oh my God, it's falling. And at that point, you see a spiky bottom and very aggressive buying, and it goes straight up from there. Now, that's if we're going to have an upside resolution to this. You and I have been of a mindset that the most likely resolution scenario was a retest of the lows, might be higher, might be lower than the previous low, and then we move back up and retrace the entire move, moving to new all-time highs. There's a lot of people, including Julian in today's interview, saying, hey, the highs are in, the top is in, this market is heading lower. So the question then becomes, what if I'm wrong about this? And we do see a breakdown below this 2600 level, but it keeps going. And I think we need to go through and look at this in terms of how various past corrections have played out. We need to bring a chart in to look at what 1987 looked like. You put together a great book of charts. Why don't you walk us through it?
Well, actually, just the first four pages are just going back to what we looked at in the past. And so I just put them in there so those of our listeners that did not listen to those shows or did not see those chart books can just get an idea of what we talked about back when we did. I really think we should just start off on page five, where we updated the chart to where we currently are. And really what we have in those red boxes, which define as to what past market corrections have done and where we would have gone if if this template played out. And so we find ourselves currently, obviously, retesting that 2600 level where all the closing prices were contained during the February sell-offs. And a lot of people are fishing to see whether or not this is the extent of a retest of the bottom end. And by all accounts, it can be. The real question, which I have to agree with you, is the idea, have we seen the big top? Is Julian right? Are the tops in for this bull market? You know, I actually think our scenario still can fit Julian's, because often a retest of the previous highs is just a retest. We could have theoretically back in January seen the high prints or a level that will be the overhead resistance for the next rally higher. And so I don't think that Julian's view would be even wrong or out of sync with ours. I mean, the big question that we're trying to ask is this sell cycle, is there enough catalyst in the imbalances that, you know, guests like Chris Cole and Devin Anderson and Kevin Muir and all the others were talking about, that from the vol complex, that could spill into a much heavier sell cycle where the liquidation is now becoming very systematic and all the rebalancing has to come in, and that suddenly it opens the floodgate and drops. Not my favorite scenario, but what we did here, and I think you can speak to it as well, is on pages 6 and 7, what we did was we looked at the what-if scenarios for a 1987 style crash. And I think that on page 6, where we actually put the Dow Jones Industrial Average during the 1987 crash, we can see a very similar pattern play out like we're seeing right now, which is we had a top, we had about a 1 month market correction, and we had a rally that was just a retracement of the prior drop. And then in 87, the market just had the bottom fall out and drop. And to be honest, you can't really rule it out at this moment. It looks like if the market did something like this, it could still happen. It's just not my favorite scenario.
Exactly. And, you know, I think this really presents a difficult challenge for anyone to navigate this market, because let's say 2600 doesn't hold and we move down below 2500 into, let's say, the 24 something handle, between 2400 and 2500. It's tempting at that level to say, oh my gosh, the crash is on. It's 1987 all over again. Go short. We're headed towards below 2000 on the S&P. On the other hand, I think there's plenty of room for this correction pattern to play out as a correction with a bottom somewhere between 2400 and 2475. And I would expect a spiky bottom and then aggressive buying after that that takes us fairly quickly back up above 2600 on the way to, could be new highs, it could be a double top that is just a retest of that 2880 to 2900 level where we got last time. That's the scenario that I still favor as the most likely possibility. But it's also possible that we're done to the downside here, that this retest of the 200 day was all that we needed. We saw some pretty good buying today on Thursday. Maybe that continues next week and we just head up from here. Maybe we break down and we get the 2400s and then we go higher. Or maybe we break down and things really start to accelerate and it really is the 87 style of crash. I will be extremely surprised if we get an 87 style crash that starts next week. I think what's much more likely is some kind of resolution that takes us markedly higher from here, either to new highs or a retest of the old highs. And then later in the year, I would expect much more turbulence.
Well, you know, Eric, I was just going to give a little pushback on today's rally, because as far as I'm concerned, I think today's rally was pretty pathetic. On a points basis, when you see a percentage in the big green numbers, it looks like a big move. But I always look at a move relative to its prior move. So there's a proportionality. This is why I love Fibonacci analysis and things like this. And as far as I'm concerned, the NASDAQ barely mustered up a 50% retrace of that big down day we had just a few days ago. And to me, this is not the type of a rally that I would have expected to see if the buyers were really buying the dip. As far as I'm concerned, we should have been north of 2,700 in short order if the buyers were for real. I'm still highly suspicious that next week can still bring in something a little more scary.
I agree with you completely. And so why don't we just go through the different scenarios that are possible and kind of rank them? I think that we both agree that the scenario that the bottom is in and we're headed entirely uphill from here and everything's better starting next week, you and I both think that's very unlikely. Probably the next unlikely scenario that we both don't think is happening, but could be, is 1987 all over again, and we're headed straight down to 1500 from here. It's all over. That I also think is very unlikely. The next scenario is we do break down below 2600, get down, let's say, into the 2400 someplace, find a bottom there. And from that bottom, we see the kind of aggressive buying that you're talking about that really shows us there's a firm rejection. The bottom really is in. We're persuaded of that. And we see a move, let's say, for sure, above 2,700 to 2,750. Now, whether it goes all the way above 2,900 to new highs or just goes and becomes kind of a double top pattern, I don't really have a strong opinion at this point, but I think that that scenario is probably the most likely of the various ones that are on the table.
Absolutely. You know, and, you know, while there is always a chance the bottom is in and that was the reversal, it's not my favorite scenario. I'll agree with you completely. To me, and one thing I've been doing with a lot of my members is getting them psychologically ready to buy the dip. It's so important at this stage because, you know, when you see the fear greed index, I think the CNN money fear greed index is ranking at 7, like extreme fear. And you can feel it. You can feel the energy in the markets and everyone is so scared. And when we have that kind of fear, it sets up for usually what is a 48-hour sell cycle. It's usually the worst part of the selling always usually capitulates in a 2-trading-day session. It's like a market puke. It just hits extremely oversold conditions. You have put-call ratios spike. You have the McClellan oscillator just shoot to the downside. You have another massive spike in the VIX, and the vol complex gets a big shock. And then suddenly everyone just buys the dip and it's over. And there's a chance that that's going to be seen next week.
Let's talk through that specific scenario. Let's suppose that there's 2 really heavy selling days next week. And let's talk to our listeners about how you might play that, because it seems to me like a real conundrum here. On one hand, for all the reasons you just described, it sounds like that's where you need the courage to buy the dip, buy that capitulation low, and look for that aggressive selling to take us all the way back above 2750. The thing is, Patrick, we both said less than 5 minutes ago, hey, this could be the start of 1987 all over again. So how do you know which is which? Is it catching a falling knife problem? How do you know where the low is so you know what to buy, first of all? How do you know when that capitulation is in? And how do you know that you're not just buying a little bounce before the real bottom falls out and 1987 really does happen again?
Well, active traders are feeling it, right? So they'll turn around, they'll put on a buy. If they see it follow through, they'll stick and add to it. And if they don't see the follow through, they'll be on the sell side of that and back on the sidelines very quick. And so there's a day trader way to game it if you're sitting in front of a computer all day long and you can mess around with it. But those investors that don't sit in front of a computer and watch it, I mean, at some point, even though the volatility is so very high, one of the just psychological ways that you could try to buy a bottom is just to buy some call options. It's very expensive, but at the same time, we have extreme volatility. So, you know, you have to kind of argue whether or not the option is mispriced. I mean, an S&P that can whip 100 S&P points in a day is a 20% vol expensive on an option. Maybe not, right? And so at some point, you want to use some sort of risk manage way to try to catch a falling knife. I always say with options, it's sort of like catching a falling knife with a chainmail glove on. You have a chance of it may sting a bit, but you're not going to get your arm cut off.
And I suppose another way to manage that risk is if you use fairly short-dated options so that you're not paying a lot for optionality. Even if your option expires in just a few weeks, well, by then you'll know what the direction is, and you can replace that option by exercising it with an outright long if you have gained confidence in the market at that point and don't want to pay for continuing optionality.
I don't mind that strategy, but the very short-term options are the ones that have the highest implieds, right? right? And the longer term ones actually don't have the same spikes in the vol. And so if you actually are more convinced that it's actually a bottom into, let's say, a May-June rally, by buying a longer dated option, you're not going to get that big vol spike and that big vega contraction the same way as if you buy a very short-term one. But the short-term one is good if you're willing to exercise it. You buy a call option, if you're right about the bottom, you can always exercise it and take on the ownership of the underlying, and you just paid a couple weeks of high vol premium, but you've positioned very well into your purchase, right?
Right. So I guess the key there to summarize this is you only play that strategy if you're going to be ready to exercise and take the market risk that goes with converting your option into outright exposure, even if the move that you're expecting has only just begun. Well, folks, with that, we're going to ask again for your help promoting the program. The more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best feature interview guests. The benefit to you of registration is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It just contains a list of links to all of the coolest stuff that we could find, downloads like our feature interview guest downloads, as well as our post-game downloads, as well as other research that we find on the internet. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right, well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Julian, as well as the links to the chart book from Julian, as well as the chart book we discussed here in the post game. There's also an article from Bank of America asking if a new bear market has begun, as well as in an oilprice.com article about Barclays expecting a $51 oil price this year. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend or myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.